In many ways, it goes back to that verse in 1 John 3 that we will be like him, for we will see him as he is.
Arthur Holder is a priest of the Episcopal Church and also a historian and professor of Christian spirituality at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, where for many years he served as dean and vice president of academic affairs. His current research explores how medieval Christians imagined what it means to seek God and become like God, theological subjects that inform several branches of Christianity, including the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, my own faith community. We talked about the implications of these doctrines in the medieval period and in our own.
It's that unity of understanding and of kind of meeting of the not only of the minds, but of the hearts, because we will see him as he is, and you can't see God as God is without being changed yourself.
I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Arthur Holder is one of those people whose reputation precedes him, not only for the strength of his scholarship, but for his great influence as a teacher and university leader, and, I'll add, for his kindness and generosity. Arthur, I'm honored you'd take the time to talk with me.
It's a pleasure to be here, man. I've been looking forward to it.
Now, I usually ask our guests about how they imagine the place of faith in their life and work. In your case, as a priest, you preach about faith, presumably, but you're also a scholar and teacher, so perhaps I can put the question to you this way. How do you imagine faith in your academic labor?
Well, I'll tell you, pretty much the same way that I do and imagine faith in all the other aspects of my life. And actually, I'll tell you a story that I've used in sermons from time to time that for me really expresses the way I have experienced faith, both in academia and elsewhere. After my freshman year in college, I spent a summer on the work crew at Koinonia Farm in South Georgia, where Clarence Jordan had started an intentional Christian community, very important part of my own formation. And the work crew was being housed in some tents about half a mile away from the main house. And we would be in the main house for meetings, worship, various things. And then after dark, would be walking that half mile back to the tent that was our home. Out in the country in South Georgia, no street lights. So there were different ways to find your way home. Sometimes somebody remembered to bring a flashlight and you could see a little bit in front of you. Sometimes the moon was out and it was just, you could see clear as day. But sometimes the only way to get from one place to the other going through the woods was to look up, because you could see the opening of the trees on between the trees on either side. And you just had to trust that the people who had cut that path led to the right place. And the people who'd walked that path before had gotten to the right place. For me, those are all different kinds of faith, but faith is a way of walking through the woods. That's the way that I think about it.
That's a great story. I can see why you've used that in sermons. That's powerful, Arthur. Thank you. You know, you told me that you began your studies as an English major, as an undergraduate, before taking up historical theology. What drew you to theology? And not only to theology, but to the historical tradition of theology?
Yeah, because I feel like I'm not all that interested in theology. I am. I've read a lot of theology, but I'm really more interested in, as we'll talk about later, I'm sure, spirituality. So the practice of faith, the way in which the lived experience of Christians through the ages, and that involves thinking about it. So theology is a part of that. It was really what the connection, as you said, between my undergraduate studies in English literature and my graduate studies in historical theology really was of a piece. And I tell you what, though, what made the change for me is that I realized that where I was finding nourishment in my own life that I wanted to be able to share with other people, and I'd start talking about, you know, the metaphysical poets or T.S. Eliot or W.H. Auden or these, and they would say, oh, yeah, I've never read that. And I thought, well, gosh, I've got to get people to read these things. And then I thought, but you know, they've read the Bible. This, you know, in the Southeast in the Bible Belt back in the 1970s. And I said, and it's got all that good stuff in there too. So the switch for me was really about finding a more, I mean, not, it sounds more strategic than it really was, but finding a way to engage with people about the interpretation of texts and the light of their own lives, and being able to do that within this tradition and a gathered community really made a difference. And there are people who are able to do that certainly with English literature, as you do. But for me, I found that it was really that historical tradition that made that most possible.
Well, you know, you certainly have done a good job with that, Arthur, because you have been a very influential mentor on many, as I've heard from people I know in the field. I, too, am interested in spirituality. We'll talk about that later. The difference is you know more theology than I do, historical theology, certainly. But on that subject, maybe we'll make a segue from there. Yep. You know, we first met and spoke in a corner of the book exhibit at the Conference of the American Academy of Religion and Society of Biblical Literature. It's about a year and a half ago. And you told me there you were interested in my affiliation with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because of ways its theology intersects with subjects to which you devoted a great deal of study. And one of these areas concerns the vision of God, something about which you've written relative to the early medieval theologian Bede. I'm interested what moved you to take up this subject.
Yeah, well, partly it came to me because I was reading text in the early Christian period and the early medieval period where Bede was in the 8th century. It's all over. So it's like, I can't skip that. But people have skipped it. It has been not as carefully attended to. And I think partly because there has been you know, off and on, but a reaction against mysticism, against, what can we say about that? Mysticism is about mystery, and mystery is stuff that we don't know. So why should we talk about things
right,
we don't
right.
know? But I think in recent years, not only in systematic theology, but in popular culture as well, there's been more of an openness to mystery as a positive thing. And the whole apophatic tradition in Christianity and in other faiths as well, of God as unknowable and yet inviting. Mm-hmm. And for me, the vision of God tradition speaks to that. It's God is there to be seen, but you can't see God. So it's that that paradox which really strikes home for me in many ways.
I love the way you put that, God as unknowable and yet inviting. That's a really provocative formulation, Arthur. You sent me this really great article that is titled Bede's Perfecti. Did I say that correctly? Perfecti?
Yeah, that's right. The perfect people.
Yeah. Yeah. So the perfect people, according to Bede, the vision of God and the foretaste of heaven. And I want to ask you about a couple passages, a couple ideas that you share in that article. You discuss how biblical passages can seem a little contradictory on the subject of seeing God, right? On the one hand, we find assertions that no man hath seen God at any time. This is from 1 John and the King James Version. But on the other hand, and this is now from the book of Exodus, that the Lord spake unto Moses face to face, right? As a man speaketh unto his friend, right? Yeah. How did Bede resolve that apparent contradiction?
Yeah. Well, he really had two ways of doing that on his mentors, Augustine from the 4th, early 5th century, and Gregory the Great in the late 6th century. And the way that Augustine said was, well, it's because when Moses or Paul or the other mystics, when they saw God, they were in a state of ecstatic consciousness or unconsciousness, where they were really dead. They were dead to the world, as it were. They were dead to their senses. And so they, it's true, no one can see God and live, but they weren't alive in that sense. They were dead to the world. Gregory the Great, and I think Bede more followed him, said, well, there are two kinds of seeing. There's seeing through a glass darkly, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians, and then there's seeing face to face. And you can't see God in that full sense, perfect sense. In the really, to see God, you have to be completely united with God, and you can't do that in this life. So that's the way that it gets resolved. Two kinds of seeing.
Okay, all right. Now, two kinds of seeing. So you mentioned Augustine and his view, and then Gregory the Great, you know, more like the way Bede kind of resolves that tension. And I'm sort of quoting here a bit from page 266 of your article, but you say that, well, Bede believed that, I'm quoting here, the full vision of God in his essence is reserved for the saints in the life to come. That's your line. That nevertheless, he asserted that the vision of God as a foretaste of heaven is enjoyed by some people in this life. Are Bede's ideas on that subject unusual? And if not, what makes his articulation of them significant?
Yeah, not unusual in teaching that there are some glimpse of God in this life, but not fully realized until the life to come in heaven. So that's pretty standard teaching. But Bede's use of the term foretaste is somewhat unusual, not unprecedented. John Cassian mentions it once, Gregory the Great twice, but in Bede, he uses that word, I think, 13 times. The foretaste of heaven is what that vision of God is. And I think it's connected. What makes it a foretaste of heaven is that in heaven, our experience of God is promised to be unmediated, direct. Whereas in this life, it's through reading the Bible, it's through saying our prayers, it's through fellowship with other Christians, it's through serving the poor. All of these are the way, through nature, these are the ways God speaks to us, but always through some other intermediary. The mystical vision is a foretaste of heaven because it's just, if you will, zap. And there's, you can prepare for it only in the sense of being receptive. There's nothing, it's a gift. And so in a sense, Bede never makes anybody feel guilty because they haven't had mystical experience. It's like, oh, that was God's choice. You didn't have that. But you should be open to it, and you should be prepared for it if that gift comes. Bede, like most writers really in that period, he never claims anything for himself. He doesn't say, I've had a vision of God. He just says, the Bible says some people have. And I think when he talks about St. Cuthbert, one of the great saints in his part of Northern England, I think he describes Cuthbert having a vision of God, but only for a second, for a glimpse. He always emphasizes how it's occasional, unexpected, brief, and not to be held onto. That's what the vision of God is like in this. That's why it's a foretaste. It's only a foretaste.
Okay, only a foretaste granted by God. You know, if for most people, Bede's idea was that we approach God through, reading the Bible, through, sort of hearing the Word of God, through nature. Yeah. Why is it that God, according to Bede, certainly, why does God grant this foretaste to some people? What's the purpose of it?
For encouragement. I think that it gives us a sense that it's not just a fantasy. It's not just somebody made this up. There have been actual people who have, people just like flesh and blood, just like you and I, who have had that direct, unmediated experience occasionally, very briefly, rarely, but they have had it. And so I think it's that he sees it as God's kind of partial payment in advance. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, it's that token of that of what is to come that enables you to trust the promise that is going to be fulfilled eventually. But because of that, it doesn't need to be something that everybody experiences or that even some people experience frequently. Actually, as long as, I mean, really, I think as long as Jesus had it, that's enough, would be enough. There are others who've been able to be granted that grace as well.
Okay, so encouragement. You know, I'm always interested about how theological ideas inform our own religious lives. In my case, for example, the idea that you know, in my own faith tradition, that we may behold God does not mean that I think that I actually will. Certainly not in this life, as I understand it. But it does make God seem a little less distant to believe that God can, you know, and on occasion may, right, manifest himself. Without making God seem familiar, it does make God seem a little more approachable. It makes me more mindful of the connection that I do feel to God, such as that connection is. Mm-hmm. Does that resonate with you, or does Bede's theology of the vision of God suggest a slightly different idea from what I'm articulating?
No, I think it fits very well with what Bede's saying. What resonates so much with me with Bede is that he puts a lot more emphasis on the longing than on the fulfillment. Mm. And he says that actually the longing itself is a kind of satisfaction. And he also, following Augustine and the other early church writers, says even if we're not going to be fulfilled in the sense of saying, thanks God, I appreciated that vision, had enough, you know, now what else you got? No, you're never satisfied. It's always more, 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 because God is infinite. And so actually one of the most profound experiences of God that we can have in this life is the acknowledgement of God's unknowability and infinity, because that's what God is. So, yeah, but it's that longing, that yearning, that sense of, and, you know, I spent a lot of time with Bede's commentary on the Song of Songs, which he interprets as kind of the exchange, a dialogue of love between God and the church, a very traditional way of understanding that in the Christian tradition. But it's one of the remarkable things about the Song of Songs is that the lovers never in that text consummate their love for each other. They just keep longing, even to the very end of the text.
Right.
Bede makes a lot of that. It's like, there he is. Oh, there he's gone. You know, he's gone. No, he's coming. He's coming back again. Right. Oh, no, he's gone again. He said, yeah, that's the way it is, the life of faith. Yeah.
Do you, I'm curious how this doctrine resonates with your students at the Graduate Theological Union. Do you teach this to them? Does it land with them in a way that they respond to, or is it just foreign to their experience?
Well, of course, I mean, at the Graduate Theological Union, we've got a lot of people who are interested in religion. So these are folks that are predisposed to at least be interested in these things. But I do teach courses in Christian mysticism and encourage students to connect it, what they're reading, what they're contemplating with their own experience. And yeah, they do make the connection. I mean, it's not that people say, oh, I saw God last night, you know, and I'll tell you what God looks like. But they say, oh, that longing or the darkness and the glimpses of clarity that come occasionally. Yes, that's the way life is for me too. And so I think at an emotional level, and there's so much about the testimonies of the mystics and those who write about them that is really directed at the affections, at the emotions. It's not just a head thing. And people do relate, our students do relate to that. I relate to that.
Yeah, certainly. I do too. And the way you give expression to it, Arthur, I really do. I think I really appreciate that. Let me maybe switch gears here just a little bit, slightly. You kindly sent me an essay, which is not yet in print, on the subject of Bede's view of deification. This is a doctrine that has a place in Latter-day Saint theology, and I love how you give expression to it in Bede's theology. You write, and I'm quoting here, that Bede was a fervent proponent of what Christian theological tradition has called deification or divinization, the Greek theosis, a process of transformation in which believers are united with God by participation and share so deeply in divinity that they become like God, taking on the attributes of immortality, incorruptibility, and holiness of life. You know, it's a beautiful doctrine, Arthur, and I'll ask the question here, like I posed above. What moved you to take up this subject? And for that matter, what moved Bede to take it up?
Well, I'm bold to say I think that we were both moved by the same thing, which is the incarnation of God in Christ. And deification in its relation to incarnation, theosis, becoming God, in relation to kenosis, the self-emptying of God, the term that Paul uses in Philippians 2 to talk about the self-emptying of God in Christ, who humbled himself and took on the form of a servant, suffering even death on a cross. So I think when I, if you had asked me before I really made a serious study of this, what I thought about deification, just that term, becoming God, I would have said, well, it sounds like hubris. It sounds like overreach. It's like I'm striving to be human, you know.
Right. Let's start there. If I could pull that off,
I'll be in pretty good shape. I'm not, you know, don't need to be God, just give me to humanity. But what I realized in reading Bede and the other early Christian writers on this is they're saying, yeah, that's the same thing. You want to be fully human. You want to fulfill your potential. You want to find well, the way to do that is to be, as Paul says, in Christ, to be incorporated into the life of the source of life. There's no other way to be human than to be in relationship with God, not fully human. And so it's that, and then you find, so what is God like? God is the one who humbles himself and becomes a servant for the sake of the world. That's life. That's true, full joy. And so deification and incarnation, theosis and kenosis go together. And that's what I think drew me to this, was because I began to understand deification as a way of not just reaching the heights, but of plumbing the depths of human experience as well.
I love that, Arthur. And I think I love the way you give expression to that. And that resonates with me, the thought that, you know, it's when I feel closer to God in some way, whether through my own devotion or, you know, through grace, I feel more intensely human, right? And these things really do go together. And that idea of height and depth being explored in conjunction with each other, I really love that. You mention in that, because again, this is a manuscript of an article that will be coming out, but it's not out yet, but you mention in that the doctrine of deification was, and I'm quoting you here, as pervasive and influential in the Latin West as it has long been acknowledged to have been in the Greek East. Now, few Latter-day Saints appreciate how widely this doctrine or some version of it pervades Christian theology. Is this theology still pervasive today, or has its influence waned over time?
It sort of seesawed back and forth, I think you could say. Well, it had a serious waning in the late 18th, 19th century with the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. And then has been kind of gradually in some ways recovered in Western Christianity. Some would say it really hasn't ever disappeared. I mean, certainly throughout the Middle Ages, especially in the mystical tradition, but not only there, you find it. if not the word itself of deification, the concept of being divinized, of human transformation through the power of God, redemption being more than just the forgiveness of sins, but being also the transformation of the human person into holiness, into fullness of life. Very strong in Luther, in Calvin, especially in Wesley. I grew up in the Methodist tradition, and John Wesley and Charles Wesley's hymns are full of this divine life that permeates the human being. So, but then with in the 19th century reaction against this, the great church historian Adolf von Harnack said, well, you know, this is just an importation for the Greek mystery religions. It's contamination, a corruption of the pure gospel, which was just all about love of God and neighbor and none of this, you know, fancy stuff about becoming divine. And so it really had to, people then began to say, interestingly enough, kind of paradoxically, because the Eastern Church, many of the Orthodox theologians said, this is something distinctive to our tradition, and the West doesn't have it or has lost it. And that prompted Western theologians to go back and wait, is that true? Did we really get rid of that? Because it sounds like a good thing. And then they said, no, it's there all along. It's in Luther. So I think there's been that kind of recovery. Interestingly, in evangelical circles, evangelical Protestant circles, a lot of interest now in deification, certainly among pastors as well as scholars, because of their recovery of the early Christian tradition. And they're finding that it's there, and then reading the Bible through that interpretive tradition and saying, oh, it's just right there in Paul. It's there in 1 John. It's there in Philippians. So, I believe in the Bible, so it must be part of my tradition too, and that kind of recovery. I think it has to do with the hunger that people have for a faith that makes a difference and is able, I think being in a secular, increasingly secularized society also has something to do with that. It's like, what do Christians have to offer the world? What do we find for ourselves that you can't find in, you know, just reading good books and getting a good education and, going to the gym and being part of the political life and, you know, all those good things that Christians do and everybody else does. What else is there? Well, this is something.
Absolutely.
Becoming part of the life of God. Yeah.
Absolutely. There's a sentence, two sentences actually there's the piece you sent me is beautiful, Arthur. I love it. But there are two sentences I've highlighted here on this one page that go to what you just said. And I wonder if there's any more you want to say to it or if you just want to say, I just said that, Matt. But here's what you wrote.
If you like it that much, why don't you read it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I really appreciate this about what else is there. You write this in Bede's Understanding of Salvation. Christian discipleship begins with divine grace and the forgiveness of sins, but must then proceed to amendment of life, the cultivation of virtues, and dedicated service to the neighbor. Moreover, the transformation effected by grace is a change of character in one's very being, not just in behavior, right? It's not just about the goal to go to the gym, and it's not just about the good books that we read that make us feel good. I mean, it's really about a change that is a change is something profound in how we, not just how we relate to the world, but how we feel we are in the world, who we feel we are, how we see ourselves. I find that to be really moving in what you comment on here in that piece.
Yeah, thank you very much. For me, that really is the heart of the matter. And in many ways, it goes back to that verse in 1 John 3 that I think we've talked about before, that we will be like him, for we will see him as he is. Mm-hmm. It's that being like God, the restoration of the image and likeness of God, participation is an important word, participation in the life of God. And in this understanding of seeing, and this is how it connects to the vision of God we were talking about earlier, seeing is unification. You can't fully see something without becoming a part of it. And a lot of this is drawing on the Platonic philosophical tradition, but I think it makes sense too, just in common sense. We think of to say, oh, now I see.
Right.
I see what you mean. You know, there it's that unity of understanding and of kind of meeting of the not only the minds but of the hearts, because we will see him as he is, and you can't see God as God is without being changed yourself.
Yeah, good.
It's got to be that transformation.
Nice. Oh, that's great. I there are times we can look at things and not understand them. I'm talking to you over Zoom. I don't know the first thing about how Zoom works, but that sense of seeing, right? So I see, right? Yeah. That really is a very different kind of experience, and it is transformative. You know, one of the things I love about the theology you describe, and something I would love for some, at least in my own faith community, to ponder a little more, is the importance of beauty to the vision of God, right? Beauty along with goodness and truth. How do you understand the theological importance of beauty? And is it important to you for the same reason it was important to Bede?
Yeah, it was certainly really important to him. And I think this is one of his, he's not the only person who says this. A lot of people talk about the beauty of God. It's all over, you know, worship the Lord and the beauty of holiness. It's right there in Psalms. But a verse that was so important to Bede was from Isaiah 33, verse 17, where it says, your eyes will see the king and his beauty. Mm. And he took that as a promise of the vision of God and of seeing Christ the king in his beauty. And matter of fact, we're told that's what he was saying on his deathbed. I'm ready to depart and be with Christ so that I can see the king in his beauty. He quotes that verse more times than any other Latin patristic writer. It's kind of his signature line. And I think that for me, that speaks very powerfully, because if we look at the triad of goodness and truth and beauty, goodness speaks to our moral character, truth speaks to the intellect, but beauty speaks to the heart, to the emotions, to I think of as being really sort of the engine that gives us as human beings motivation. And it certainly in my own experience of faith, it's been through music, through poetry, hymns, through experiences of nature. If you ask me, you know, what are the times that you have felt closest to God? Very few of them are going to be, well, that time that I finally figured out, you know, this problem, abstract problem. Even if I have had wonderful times when I've said, you know, this is a long time ago, but when I understand, I think I understand trigonometry, you know, when I was a high school senior for a moment there, it was a glimpse. I thought, okay, I think I've got it. But in many ways, that's an aesthetic experience. It's the coming of things into a whole. And I've talked to friends who are scientists who say, oh yeah, it's the beauty of the universe that moves me so much as a scientist. I think it's not the abstraction, it's that enfleshment.
Yeah, I love that. One of the classical definitions of beauty, you know, as the unity amid variety, you know, kind of that intuition that suddenly, it really is like that, I see how this all fits, and it's beautiful. Yeah, that it appeals, it draws, it lures. That's great, Arthur. You know, for me, as I think about what you're talking about, as I think about this principle in my own faith community, the idea of becoming that God isn't a principle of power, you know, acquiring the power of God. Mm-hmm. It's more one about relationship, right? Becoming more like God so as to be able to dwell more closely with God, hopefully, right? What do you say to Christians who find these kinds of doctrines about, well, earlier about seeing God or becoming that God, who find them blasphemous? Do you encounter much of that?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think they're, as I said, my own reaction when you first hear that, it's like, do you want to be God? No, that's why. I don't fit the job description. But once people do understand the caveats that are put around this doctrine throughout the tradition, it's like we become by grace what Christ is by nature. We are he's the natural Son of God. We are the adopted children of God. There is the infinite qualitative distinction between God and humanity remains, and in fact is the foundation of the doctrine, because otherwise there's no deity to participate in. We're not taking over God's job. We remain dependent upon that. So I think in some ways all of the literature about it has, in modern times, God with a capital G, we become gods with a little g. We're not becoming the God, we're becoming divinized. We are being charged with the power of God. The Eastern Orthodox tradition, since Gregory of Palamas in the 14th century, makes the distinction between God's essence and the energies of God, and says we participate in those energies, kind of the glow that God gives off, if you will. We don't become the essence of God. And I think that's, from what I understand, true in your tradition as well, that it's not that people then go set up shop and become their own, Godhead. That distinction remains throughout.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Joseph Smith, who's the one that, unfolds a lot of this theology from my tradition, has some very interesting things to say about God, God's nature, human nature, that differs in some respects from the larger Christian tradition. But a lot of what you said right there really rings true for mine as well. Certainly, there's never any kind of aspect or idea that we surpass God in might. It's not like that at all. What you said is very well put, Arthur. I mean, we just have a few minutes left. I wonder if I could ask you something. It goes back to something you said earlier in our conversation, how you were interested in Christian spirituality, that's really what draws you more than theology. Now, you have served as president of the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality, and you published and edited really important work in the field. That's how I got to know your name. I actually was reading some of your work. And you've also served as a teacher and mentor to so many scholars of Christian spirituality. In the time that you worked in the field, have there been developments in it that really encourage you, or are there any that concern you? What's the state of the field of Christian spirituality studies?
Yeah, I'd say some of both, some encouragement and some concerns. I'm really encouraged by increasing attention, not just in the academic study of Christian spirituality, but I think in the way that it's being appreciated and spread in local churches and in popular literature and other things as well, with engagement with the world beyond the walls of the church, the sense that spirituality is not just me in my prayer closet. It is that, but not just that. And so connections with popular religion, with what the sociologists call lived religion, and then moving beyond fascination with denominational diversity. I think when I first came into the academic study, years ago, that was what was really interesting was, what's the Lutheran view on that? What's the Roman Catholic view on that? What's the LDS view on that? So it was this, and that's great. I mean, I teach at an ecumenical and interreligious consortium, but moving beyond that to also appreciating cultural diversity and realizing the diversity within each of our denominational traditions. I think there's been a complexification of that diversification of diversity within spirituality that's been helpful. And then seeing spirituality as a foundation for how we can address environmental issues and racial justice and economic sustainability and all kinds of other things. Like this, the spirituality and whatever is, those are all spirituality and medicine, for instance, very important. So as far as concerns, you know, spirituality, I have a, my late friend and colleague, Owen Thomas, used to say it, historically, the current spirituality movement is a romantic movement, capital R. It has the advantages and the disadvantages of all romantic movements. And part of that is the temptation for it to get unmoored from its foundations and to leave aside the other elements of religion. I think of Baron von Hugel in the early 20th century, who, you know, said there are three elements of religion: the doctrinal, the institutional, and the mystical. And there's a temptation, I guess, always for those who are interested in that mystical element to say, what's good about spirituality is it doesn't have anything to do with institutions or doctrines. Right. But if you take that away, it really doesn't have anything to do with anything.
That's right.
So I think we have to continue to attend to that, maintaining that connection.
Thank you for that perspective. That was very well well put, Arthur. And your, you know, your view of it is I mean, so much better than mine, given I'm really new to the field. I love it. Something I appreciate too about you, what you said about the increasing diversity that we see within and across single traditions, as well as across different faith traditions. I think that's really important. There is something about spirituality that can also serve as a unifier. There's something, again, back to the beauty element. There's something beautiful, I find, Arthur, in what you are articulating, even in places where it may differ somewhat from my own faith tradition. Like myself, there's goodness, there's truth in what Arthur is saying. I find it beautiful. And spirituality is a unifying quality that way, which I really, really love. Can I close with asking you this question here? There's a verse of scripture in my own religion that states that we are to grow through study and by faith. Now, as a scholar and a priest, you certainly exemplify both of those things. If you could encourage people to study one thing so as to increase their faith, what would that be?
Whatever engages your passion. I think Augustine was right saying that if God created the world and all knowledge, then there is no knowledge outside of God. It was poetry. For me, it's interpretation of texts, but that doesn't speak to everybody. I mean, so for some people, it was the science, it was the human relations, whatever it may, find your way in and then follow it all the way through. There's nothing to be afraid of that is going to be leading you away from God if you follow it all the way, because everything comes from God and will return to God.
That's a great way to conclude this discussion, Arthur. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and your learning. I should have you back on to talk again at some point, because I gain a lot from this discussion.
Thank you so much. Well, I would love to do that, and I have enjoyed listening to some of the other podcasts and look forward to all the rest of you. You're doing a great service for all of us by doing this. So thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Arthur. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Sam Jacob. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you're interested in other episodes of this podcast or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.